From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe Past and Present. Occasionally, we invite visitors to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe and interact with students. And this blog series will bring you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. And today, we're fortunate to have Bradley Abrams, a PhD from Stanford, who taught for 10 years at Columbia and served for 5 years as the Associate Director of the Harriman Institute, also at Columbia. And Brad's work is on the early years of the communist transition after World War II, and most recently is on consumerism in Czechoslovakia in the 1970s. And so I'd like to begin by asking you about how you came to your first topic. And what is it about that topic? How do you see it differently now than the way that you saw it when you first encountered it?
Thank you for having me, Holly. Well, I actually came to the topic in a rather strange way because I had received a Fulbright to go to Czechoslovakia to work on a somewhat different topic, actually a radically different topic, on Jews in Bohemia in the 19th century. And I was slated to go in September of 1989, but I had some other obligations, publishing a paper. I was working with a professor at Stanford on a project. And so I asked to delay until January of 1990. And as everyone who's listening to this well knows, a small revolution happened in between those two dates, meaning that when I called and I said, should I still come in January, I was told by the Fulbright office, you know, everything's a mess over there. Why don't you just wait and go with next year's cohort in September of 1990? So I began to cast around for another topic, thinking that now with the presumptive opening of the archives and other matters and the opening of the society, there might be the possibility for me to do a different topic, one that I would not have been able to do under the communist regime. And I knew that many people would focus on 1968 and the Prague Spring and the Warsaw Pact invasion as something that they thought was of major historical significance and needed another look now that documents had become available. So I started thinking about other times and other periods. And given that Czechoslovakia and the other countries of the region had just come out of communism, I became increasingly interested in how they got into communism. So I sat down and I wrote a very nice prospectus for a dissertation that would examine how a small clique of determined and evil communists had got together to subvert Czechoslovak democracy and bring the nice democracy-loving Czech and Slovak people into the evil Soviet bloc. And I was very excited about doing this. And I went over to Prague and I started doing research. And the more that I read from the time period, from the time at the end of the Second World War in 1945 until the communists achieved total power in February of 1948, and came to realize that I was completely wrong, and that the story that I had been able to read in the exile literature and so on, Czech exiles mostly, was not in fact really accurate. It was accurate in some respects, but not in other respects. So I realized that I could either take my prospectus and follow through on it and be wrong and essentially be lying to people, or I could put the word not in every sentence and be telling a story that held a great deal more verisimilitude. So I continued reading and continued reading, and I came up with the story that is in The Struggle for the Soul of the Nation. The title, by the way, is taken from two quotes, one from a leading non-communist political journalist, commentator, editor named Ferdinand Perotka, and one from Clement Gottwald, the head of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia. And so I found that what they envisioned was going on in Czechoslovakia between 1945 and 1948 shared certain characteristics. They both thought they were fighting essentially for the hearts and minds of the Czech and Slovak people. And so I examined in the book what the debates at the time were, trying to capture the zeitgeist to find out what the major debates were, how communists were thinking about them, how people opposed to the Communist Party were thinking of them, and how they couched these debates.
Yeah, I mean, given the extent to which this was an under-studied, under-discussed topic in Czechoslovak and later especially Czech society of the time. And once again, I'd just like to say that the title of the book that we're discussing now, The Struggle for the Soul of the Nation, subtitled Czech Culture and the Rise of Communism, was published in 2004, correct? Okay. and so I'd be curious to know what the reception of your work has been in the Czech Republic and or Slovakia or the region more generally. How do people read it and see it now?
Well, that's not an easy thing to judge because I can only talk to the people who want to talk to me about it, and they tend to think that it was a breath of fresh air and something that was really quite interesting. I expected an angry reception, and when I gave papers based on the research that I'd done for the book, I was, in fact, hissed in France, which gratified me to no end, because the average age of the audience was probably 75, and I think they still felt bad about Munich, and so anything they only want to think good things about the Czechs. I also gave a paper at the 50th anniversary commemorative conference of the communist takeover, where I was booed a bit, but not as much as I had feared. I think it was because the Czechs were in the process of winning the European Championship hockey game, and most people who were listening on the headphones, I think, had turned to the radio to hear how the hockey match was going. So, but in more recent times, actually, a Czech translation is now being prepared, which was something that I had long hoped would happen. My problem in getting it translated initially was they wanted me to come up with the original Czech for the footnotes, and although I took the notes in Czech, I didn't take them electronically. I took them on actual note cards and such, and finding each of the note cards as they moved from chapter to chapter, because I divided up, I would find all of the material that I needed for a certain chapter, and many note cards would have information from more than one chapter on them, and of course I had 10,000 photocopies and everything else, so it was just going, the amount of time that it would have taken for me, and this would have been back around in 2000, 2001, 2002, as I'm preparing this manuscript, I was talking, a colleague put me in contact with Atlantis, a publisher in the Czech Republic, and that was just going to be too time-consuming for me to do, so there is not a Czech version out. I've seen two reviews that were published in the Czech Republic, and they were both very good, but they were both written by scholars from the younger generation, younger even than you and I are, or let's say younger than I am. And they are both very positive. And I think that there really is a generational divide. I think the generation that came of age in communism and views the entire episode as an aberration from the national history is far less willing to entertain notions that there would have been enthusiasm for radical social change in Czechoslovakia after the end of the Second World War. And I found this, I gave the keynote speech at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids in, I don't remember what year this was, I think it was 2002. And elderly emigres who remembered, who were 48ers, who left Czechoslovakia after 48, were very upset with me and what I had to say. And I asked them to read the book and then to talk to me. And one of them, whose name I'm going to keep to myself, who is a historian here in the United States, an emigre who had become a historian of East Central Europe in the United States, wrote me a letter, an actual physical letter, about 2 months later, taking back everything he had said. He said, "You're right, I read it, I remember these things. It's funny how, with the passage of time, your mind, you remember the things the way you want to remember them." So I think that the reception has been good, and colleagues that in other countries, they particularly like the initial article, which is not so Czech, the initial chapter of the piece. But you asked before about how I view the work now with the passage of some time, and I never answered that. So I look back on it, and the one thing I really wish is that the book were shorter. I had cut about 150 pages out of the original manuscript, and then put in about 150 pages of new material that wasn't in the original dissertation. And in the process of shopping it around, when it was finally picked up by Roman and Littlefield in the Harvard Cold War book series, they asked me if I could cut another 20% out. And I said, look, you know, this has been 2 years since I really worked on this. I don't want to engage in it anymore. I've done what I wanted to do. And at that time, I thought that the manuscript would probably work out to be about 280 pages. And it turned out to be considerably longer. And I wish that it had been shorter, because there are things that I think probably now, unlike in 2002 or 2003, now I think probably could be left out without harming the overall argument.
So, you started working in this field before the collapse of communism, and you've worked across this period that has been extremely important for the region, especially for the countries that you work on, that you know, that has, used to be a country and now is two countries. And I was just wondering how these changes on the ground, how you have observed them. What do you see are the kind of essential aspects of the changes that have taken place across this, you know, pre-communism, post-communism? And I know that you didn't spend much time in the region before the collapse of communism. But also, and perhaps more importantly for our purposes, how the field has changed in that time, and the way you understand what the field is and how you fit into it.
Do you mean the changes in society more generally, or changes within the profession?
In terms of the field, I'm thinking of...
No, but the first half of the...
Oh, the first half? Yeah, I would say society, politics, on whatever level you want to address it.
Well, I think... I mean, I didn't travel extensively in Czechoslovakia before 1989, so I actually spent more time in East Germany, so I can't talk that much about, from personal experience, about that. What I will say is that the period from 1989, early 1990, until 1992 was a very special time in the region. And no matter where I went, although I was mostly in the former Czechoslovakia, people were on the streets and were talking about things. Newspapers mattered. Things were changing, and people had a sense that they were a part of it, I think. And I think that through scandal and corruption and various things in various places, I think the sense of excitement, the sense of being part of a common undertaking, I think this eroded much more quickly than I had hoped that it would. And I think that the rise of a sense of political, particularly political, but in other aspects as well, political cynicism really overtook the region much earlier than I thought that it would and that I'd hoped that it would. One of the interesting things now, I think the facile thing is how normal the places are and how quickly they got to be normal. If you remember reading transitology stuff and talking to people in 1990, 1991 about the future of the region, it was going to take generations, both for reasons of economic reconstruction, but also so that those Easterners could learn the habits of sort of Western consumer society. And the real problem was going to be in people's brains, even after the time that the economies had started to recover. And I think what we've seen, if you look at it based on the dire predictions of 1990, 1991, is that in two decades, most of these countries have made remarkable strides, EU membership and so on, and they've actually become normal places. I had dinner with the Slovenian foreign minister in, must have been 1994, 1995, and besides constantly repeating that we're part of Central Europe, we're not part of Eastern Europe, the other thing he said was, I want Slovenia to be Denmark. And having a Danish wife, I asked him, what do you mean by that? And he said, when was the last time you read about Denmark in the newspaper? And I said, I never read about Denmark in the newspaper. And he said, that's exactly what I mean. I want Slovenia not to be talked about. It's just a happy, small, prosperous country that doesn't, there's no news, because the only time Slovenia or the Czech Republic will get into a newspaper in the United States is if something bad happens there. So, I think that it's facile but important that these have become normal places. In terms of the historical profession over there, there really is, I think, a change in generations that's ongoing and is taking longer than I thought that it would. I mean, perhaps I expected things to happen more quickly in the Czech Republic, because in Czechoslovakia there was a law that people who had lost their positions in the Academy of Sciences because of their political ideas, i.e. 68ers really are what they were talking about, were entitled to get their positions back. So many people who'd lost their jobs in 1969, 1970 were brought back into the Academy of Sciences, and I anticipated that given their age they would probably have retired, and many now have, but we're only seeing it, I think, just now, some 20 years later, that young people in the last 5 to 10 years, because before that, the young scholars were being trained by exactly the older generation that either made it through the normalization period from 68 to 89, or had been largely absent. There was a pretty vibrant underground historical community in Czechoslovakia, but they were not able to keep up with developments in the historical profession in a global sense. So when they came back in 89, they worked under a lot of the same methodologies and theoretical underpinnings that they'd worked under in 1968, and they trained the next generation of graduate students. And it's only now in the last 10 years, as Czech and Slovak scholars, and I'm sure this is the case for other places as well, the CEU has done great service, I think, to this, but also the Erasmus program. And these students traveling to study in France or Germany or England and learning things in a more European way than I think even 10 years ago they did. So I think that the historical profession is catching up now and asking the same kinds of questions as their counterparts in the West ask. There are still, you know, notable exceptions for things that in Czech history that haven't been looked at, and I think you could say the same thing about every other country in the region. So, was that actually what you were?
So maybe you could talk a bit about how you've seen the field on this side of the Atlantic changing during the course of your career.
Well, I think that the field is undergoing serious changes, basically because of the notion of Europe and the way in which funding is handed out for the for research on various parts of the continent. In the day, East Central Europe was its own place, and there were funding streams through Title VI for people to go do research, and that money has largely dried up. It's much more difficult to find funding, which I don't think affects students, PhD students, for example, at the very top universities in the United States, but there's a lot of work to be done, and students, it's much more competitive, and there are a lot of students who have worthy projects. I've sat on the Fulbright Commission 2 out of the last 3 years, and there are worthy projects that there just isn't money to fund. And it's different than places that would be comparable in Western Europe, taking the Czech Republic. Take some place like Belgium or some place, or even Austria. Austria has a set of scholarships that are made available to American PhD students who want to come over and do research on Austria. Because Austria is richer than the Czech Republic, they can afford to do that, and the Czech Republic doesn't have the resources to be handing them out in this way. So, I mean, I think that on the one hand, there's a financial aspect to it, but on the other hand, there's the much more, I think, in a sense, sobering intellectual component to this, that there is a Europe now, defined by the European Union, and Eastern Europe, by virtue of becoming more normal, okay, less prosperous than most places, although, you know, you look at Greece or you look at Portugal even, you know, these places are within the range of Slovenia, for example, and by becoming normal, there is a need to create a European narrative, something that is European. And departments, history departments, I think, are starting to turn away from specifically hiring Eastern Europeanists and are starting to look more at saying, we're going to have this many Europeanists. One of them ought to be someone with a research focus in East Central Europe or Southeastern Europe, but who also is really a Europeanist and can talk about the development of the EU as well as talk about Hungary or Poland or Czechoslovakia or something like that. And I think that's increasingly the way that things are going to go. And in some ways, the real losers in this will be, unless we can find a good narrative, will be people who work on communism. Because you can write a narrative of European history that includes the Habsburg Empire and the Russian Empire, at least the westernmost parts of it, for the 18th century, for the 19th century. You get into the first part of the 20th century, you can talk about the rise of the Arab Cross and other fascist movements. And there are points of comparison that are Europe-wide, but for the communist era, you've got a narrative of in Western Europe, you've got a narrative of post-war reconstruction, and then increasing integration through the European Economic Community, then the European Community, then the European Union. And that's the narrative that exists. In Eastern Europe, you've got an entirely separate narrative, which follows the lifespan lifespan of communism, which is, you know, Stalinism, attempted reform, revolt in 56, then 68, then sliding towards Gorbachev. And these two narratives fit awkwardly at best with one another. So one of the things I'm trying to do in looking at consumption patterns, and to some extent also consumerism in Eastern Europe, is to try and find one of the points where these things fit across the Iron Curtain. And I think that's one of the things that Eastern Europeanists should be thinking of, not just because our livelihood is going to be more European than it was when I went to Colombia in 1997, but certainly much more than it would have been in 1986 or something like that, but also because there is a need and there are calls for some sort of a pan-European narrative.
Can you explain a bit more how you see the story of consumption and consumerism fitting into such a narrative, a pan-European narrative?
Well, in some ways, and this of course works in different places at different times, better and worse. I mean, certainly Eastern Europe in the 1950s was no consumer paradise. And certainly Romania in the early 1980s is not a consumer's paradise, and Albania virtually at no time was a consumer's paradise. But at certain times, in certain places, consumption in the East didn't look as different. It lagged, but it didn't look as different. And I think this is particularly the case for the 1970s and ultimately the 1980s. I mean, this is complicated greatly by the fiasco of the Polish debt crisis. But the first half of the 1970s in Poland was just things, personal incomes, real incomes, personal consumption, all of these things were rising very, very quickly. And you start to see the same kinds of goods being available on the market. Now, they may not be the same goods, the same color televisions in Czechoslovakia or Poland or Hungary as you were getting in Germany or France or Britain, but they were the same kinds of goods. And you see, I think, across time, two things, one which I can't really talk much authoritatively about, but that's changes in identities of people. As West and East, work weeks got shorter. People devoted more of their, both they had more time and they devoted more time to leisure. At the same time, they came, and this is, I think, part of the 60s generation, too, started to see consumption as a way of expressing who one was. What one wears tells you something about the person. What people, you know, the keeping up with the Joneses that becomes an important thing here. These kinds of things, I think, happen on both sides of the continent, maybe with different goods involved, maybe with different things acting as social markers to indicate identities. But these things, leisure time and the choice of what goods to consume, I think happen both West and East. And that's the harder one to put your finger on because you can't go back retroactively and look at somebody in 1963 and say this is what they were expressing in it's not as easy to do because this is all a choice. You can look at certain groups within various societies that are that have a clearly, the people who do the tramping in Czechoslovakia go out and carry a guitar and go out hitchhiking and going off. Those they dressed almost all the same. Okay, so they share something. The other thing is the actual goods, and that you can track. Who's making what? Who's buying what? How do these things compare east and west? Not in a we will bury you kind of way, but in a what are the defining sort of objects of consumption? What are the most desirable objects of consumption east and west? And how are these similar or different? And I think that that's one of the directions that the research that I've already done, I can say things about Eastern Europe, I can say things about Czechoslovakia, which was probably the most advanced in terms of consumerism, although goods may have been better or more widely available in East Germany in the 70s and in Hungary in the 80s, but I can talk about the 70s and the 80s, and that's where I think this really starts to come through. Another thing that I want to bring up, because I meant to do it this morning in your class and I didn't, is because I was struck when I walked in to tell you, right, there's a book on, you know, thinking about the history of the welfare state. And this is something that I think we who work on Eastern Europe might pay more attention to, because when scholars talk about the welfare state in Europe, they talk about the European welfare state, they have something very specific in mind, and they look at it and they can compare Italy to France and France to Denmark. What they don't do is look across the Iron Curtain historically, and if you think about it for just a second, the socialist experiment in Eastern Europe was the largest, most all-inclusive welfare state that ever existed. And in comparisons and in looking at how welfare states function or don't function, or what the problems are, I think that we ought to be looking at Eastern Europe as a giant experiment in welfare statism, an extremely enormous one with lots of other elements attached to it, of course. But there is a welfare state element to it that I think that scholars of welfare state politics, and it's a whole cottage industry, there's a whole group of people who work on this stuff all the time, just haven't looked at.
So I'd just like to close with one final question about the training of graduate students. So what is it that you think we should be doing when we are training the next generation of graduate students? What should we be telling them? What should we be having them read? What kinds of topics should we be talking about in seminars and in research, in their research projects?
Well, as far as what they should read, obviously they should read your book and my book. Goes without saying almost, but I'll say it anyway. With graduate students, something that I came to understand in my years at Columbia were that graduate students, who I love graduate students, they're great people, they're committed, they work very hard, and they do a good job, generally, at isolating topics. There are topics that they should be thinking about in terms of the job market. One of them is obviously thinking more about European topics, something in Eastern Europe that's important for Eastern Europe and important for understanding Eastern Europe that also has something to say to our colleagues further to the West, as for East Central Europeanists. So I think that that's something that they should all keep in mind. In terms of training graduate students, one thing that I did that my students who finished and got jobs, or the students even that were just out writing their dissertations and comparing notes on what their graduate experience was like in comparison with their friends who were also in Zagreb doing research or whatever, was we need to train them more in being professors. One of the things that I got out of graduate school was I learned how to write a book. I learned how to research and write a historical monograph. That didn't help me very much when I got up in front of my first lecture class. I had been a TA, and that's fine. I learned how to grade papers somewhat, and I learned how to get to deliver a lecture or two, and I actually taught my own seminar at Stanford in lieu of being a TA. You're allowed to substitute. But in terms of how do you put together a syllabus? That looks right. So one of my exercises with my graduate students was to have them write a sample syllabus for an Eastern European history class. They pick the time period, and they have to give a short blurb about what the lectures would be about, and readings. And you can see that some people, they said this was not easy to do, because they would put these things down to read, and then they'd see they had 600 pages of reading, and you can't make undergraduates read 600 pages. You can't even make them read 150. You can offer 150 to them. So some of the training in the nuts and bolts of being a professor, how you write a syllabus. And I liked giving this assignment because it was a self-teaching tool. They would see that they had problems, and then they would see how difficult it was. But there are other aspects, too, that I think are being neglected in favor of, reading books, writing papers, which is all important. I'm not saying it's not, but it needs to be balanced by thinking about what we as professors do in our everyday lives. I don't write books to the exclusion of doing anything else. In fact, my time was probably spent teaching, talking to students, and doing other things. I have them another assignment. This is to give an example. Is they take one of the books that we read during this colloquium, and they have to write two reviews of it. One, they have a cap of 675 words, and it's written for a professional audience, so something that you might see in AHR or something like that, you want to get to sources, methodology, argument, because we don't have time to read lots of reviews, so we want to know very quickly, what's this book about, what's the argument, do I need to read it? At the same time, the same day, they have to write a 10-page double-spaced review for the New York Review of Books. That they find very difficult because they have to find a hook, something that'll lure readers, the educated layperson, into reading a book about Marshall Antonescu, maybe, or I don't know, pick whatever you want out of this. Someone who's, maybe a real estate agent, went to college, took some Eastern European history class, took a Soviet class or something, and maybe know something, a little something about Eastern Europe, so they're going to start reading it. But to draw them in and then to talk about those same kinds of things, sources, methodology, argument, in a way that is entertaining as well as edifying. So writing to different audiences is a skill that you can't really teach. You don't have time to teach it. But you have to expose them, I think, to the sense that they're not always going to be writing in an insular community of Eastern European historians. So as far as overall graduate education, that's what I think. I think we need to be doing more to prepare them for the kinds of real-life tasks that they're going to be confronted with out in the world, because they're going to get plenty of advice on writing a dissertation. In terms of where I think research should go, or where I think it will go, not sure that this is a should, but it is a where I think it will go. I think that the European aspect is important, and finding something that appeals to Western Europeanists who are perhaps more recalcitrant to look at stuff about Eastern Europe than they should be. Although I must say, it seems to me that scholars of Russia are less interested in Eastern Europe than even Western Europe. I got the sense I was on a panel when they had the AAASS had a series of panels on the disciplines and the area studies. I was on the history one, and everyone else on the panel, there were four other people, they were all Russianists. And the one thing, when we had a meeting before the panel, and the one thing that they agreed was the Russians are far too insular. They are just not interested in anything. It doesn't have to do with Russia. If it's not Russia, it's not important. And that had to do both with Russian scholars in Russia, historians of Russia in Russia, and historians of Russia in the United States. So, I think we need to have an eye towards Europe. But with that said, there are still lots of topics that are under research, and not ones that lie far in the past, but in the relatively recent communist past, that just have not been covered very well. I think my understanding, in any of the countries of the region, the 50s are still very poorly done, mostly poorly done by historians in the region who are more interested in counting up the body counts than in trying to understand anything having to do with everyday life or other aspects. And I think the 70s and the 80s are also underdone, up until you get to Gorbachev, say. And I think this is as true for Soviet history as it is for Eastern, Southeastern Europe or East Central European history. I think the 70s and the 80s are not as well covered because the story, we know how it ends, in a sense. So, you know, everything looks towards how we get to 1989. And I think that that, unlike some of the work that's been done in East Germany, like by Mary Fulbrook or a whole swath of German scholars, which look at life in East Germany in the 70s or in the 80s on its own terms, rather than with an eye toward, say, the wall's about to fall. More generally speaking, as historians, and we were just talking about this, so I might as well throw this in here too, is that economic history has just gone by the wayside, and so my work on consumption somewhat goes towards that. It's sort of semi-economic, and it involves economic data, but understanding, I think, the economic problems of Eastern Europe is important for understanding a whole slew of other things, decisions that are made, or the decisions that were made, not just in the run-up to 89, but throughout the communist period. But more generally, just that there are so few people who understand how a Soviet economy worked at all, left to help us understand it. And I think that that's a problem in the historical profession generally. Economic history in the last 20 years has the number of departments that don't even have an economic historian on staff that are top departments in the country is just, I think, surprising and a little bit appalling. The other aspect is diplomatic history. I think it's been taken over, first of all, it's been taken over by political scientists, and it has a very presentist edge to it. And I think historians let diplomatic history slip out of their hands. And I think that that's unwise. There's been a recent resurgence, I think, in Europe, in Eastern Europe, working on diplomacy, particularly interwar diplomacy between the states of the region. But, you know, Pyotr Vandich is not going to write this France's Eastern Alliance's two-volume set. That's just, that doesn't happen anymore, and I think that we are weaker for it. So, a final anecdote that ties these two things together. I was talking with my graduate students before the 2004 election, and everybody was upset with President Bush because of what he was doing to the economy and what he'd done to America's standing in the world, his diplomatic haughtiness, let's say. And, you know, so I said, well, look at you. There's eight of you, nine of you. I know what your dissertation topics are. Not a single one of you is working on anything to do with diplomacy or economics. If historians don't do the work, I mean, these are the things that make a lot of difference in people's lives, no less so today with the Great Recession. These are the things that affect people's everyday lives and then affect the course of history overall. And we need to be much more aware of the historians.
Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to the book on consumption. So thanks for coming, Brett.